Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from The Voice of America. I'm Pete Musto.
And I'm Dorothy Gundy. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear stories from Anna Mateo and Steve Ember. But first, this report.
Frances Downey grew up listening to stories about her mother studying at a university outside of the United States. Her mother spent 1 year studying abroad through an international exchange program with a French school. She often talked about how exciting and interesting the experience was. So even before Downey finished high school, she had decided she would someday follow her mother's path. The Silver Spring, Maryland native began studying architecture at Lehigh University in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania, in 2004. Near the end of her second year, Downey started to feel unhappy with her school and decided it was time to study abroad. U.S. colleges and universities commonly have partnerships and joint programs with foreign schools that permit student exchanges. These programs usually last half or sometimes a whole school year. The classes students take abroad usually give them credit toward their degree. In a 4-year degree program, the third year is the most common time for American college students to study abroad. Many students feel they need a change before what is usually their final and most difficult year of study.
Downey said her school did not want her to go at first. The architecture program at Lehigh is very intense, and her professors were worried she might miss learning important material. However, she was eventually able to get special permission to study outside Lehigh. She chose to study internationally for a whole year. During the fall 2006 term, she attended the Danish International School in Copenhagen, Denmark. Downey said she did so because Danish architects are known for their housing design. Downey also was studying the Spanish language at the time. So she chose to spend her spring 2007 term at the University of Sevilla in Spain. Downey notes that it was not an easy experience. As a young adult on her own, it was difficult for her to deal with travel document and transportation issues. Staying in contact with friends and family back home proved difficult, too. However, she had a lot of emotional and financial support from her family. She said she learned life lessons and made friendships and memories that have lasted to this day. She liked being abroad so much that during the 2007 summer break, she spent several weeks on a study trip through Lehigh in Vicenza, Italy. The more you're out of your comfort zone, the more rewarding the experience is in the end, Downey told VOA.
Recent research suggests that the number of students with experiences like Downey's continues to grow. In November, the Institute of International Education, or IIE, released a report on international educational exchange. The IIE's Yearly Open Doors report is created with help from the U.S. Department of State. It examines the number of foreign college students entering the U.S. and the number of American college students who study abroad. This year's report shows that the number of Americans studying abroad increased by 2.3% from the school year before. More than 330,000 American students studied in foreign countries for college credit during the 2016 to 2017 school year. The number of Americans studying abroad has been growing since the early 1990s. Peggy Blumenthal is an advisor with the IIE. She said that the rate of growth shrank after the U.S. recession in 2008. But even problems like political unrest in a host country affect only the number of students going to that country. The overall growth in Americans studying abroad continues, Blumenthal said. Blumenthal notes that educators have long seen the value in international student exchanges. She said that most Americans do not travel far from home to attend a college or university. For that reason, they are not often put in situations that are unfamiliar. A study abroad program can teach students independence and important life skills. But even more schools and parents are now starting to see the value in international experience, Blumenthal said. And more companies want employees who speak foreign languages and know how to deal with people from other cultures.
Realizing that not everybody sees the world the way Americans see the world, that's crucial if you're going to succeed in a multicultural professional environment, she said. Blumenthal noted that many U.S. colleges and universities have increased partnerships with foreign institutions and companies. They also have added more short-term international study programs. These programs are usually operated by the American schools. They make it easier for students to find the finances to study abroad. The U.S. government also has expanded financial assistance for international study through its Benjamin A. Gilman and Fulbright programs. And foreign institutions are increasing efforts to match their study programs with American ones. For example, in November, France's prime minister announced a plan to get more of the country's top institutions to offer programs in English. However, Blumenthal said, there is one group of American students who do not study abroad at the same rates as others: minorities. The 2018 Open Doors report showed that while non-white students make up 42% of all college students in the U.S., only 29% of students studying abroad were non-white. Blumenthal said schools and other groups should show minority students that minorities have successfully studied abroad. They should show minorities in informational material about foreign study and have former students share their stories. That, she said, will show current minority students that the experience is a possibility for them. I'm Pete Musto.
And I'm Dorothy Gundy.
Now, from VOA Learning English, it's time for Words and Their Stories. If this is your first time with us, this program explores words and expressions commonly used in American English. We take a look at where they come from and how best to use them. So as winter officially comes to half the world, today we celebrate an expression that means winter is coming. When temperatures drop and a cold snap comes, that means one thing. Jack Frost has arrived.
He's nipping at your nose. You can feel him in your toes. A shiver and a tear lets you know Jack Frost is here.
Jack Frost represents the coming of dark, cold days. He is the personification of winter, a human form of winter weather. So when we say, Jack Frost is nipping at your nose, we mean that you feel the cold, icy effects of winter on your face. When a frost or deep freeze comes, you had better bundle up. You should wear enough clothing to stay warm. Now, Jack Frost does indeed bring the cold of winter, but he can also create beauty in nature. Some traditions claim that Jack Frost is responsible for leaving ice and snow on windows, trees, the ground, anywhere it will stick. While we know frost is a natural event, it is fun to think that an imaginary creature named Jack Frost, or another name in some other cultures, changed the world into a winter wonderland. That is what poet Hannah Flagg Gould must have been thinking when she wrote a poem called The Frost. Here are parts of that poem.
The frost looked forth one still, clear night, and he said, "Now I shall be out of sight." Then he went to the mountain and powdered its crest. He climbed up the trees, and their boughs he dressed with diamonds and pearls.
With all of its beauty and extremes, winter is a great subject for songs and poetry. But now, let's listen to how we use these wintry expressions in conversation.
Ooh, brr! It is freezing outside. This cold snap came out of nowhere.
I don't care how cold it is. I'm going on a hot date.
Is that all you're wearing? You need to bundle up, or Jack Frost will be nipping at more than your nose.
Oh, I'll be fine. I'm wearing my new coat.
That is not a winter coat. I mean, it looks great, but it's much too thin. You will catch a cold. I know, you can wear my new down coat. It keeps you warm up to minus 30 degrees Celsius.
I'm going on a date, not exploring the Arctic Circle. Thanks, but I'm not wearing that big, thick black coat. Besides, the taxi will take me from door to door.
But what if something goes wrong? What if the car skids on the ice and is involved in an accident? You'll have to walk to the restaurant. You might freeze to death.
No, I won't. I'll just call an Uber to come and get me.
And what if that vehicle runs out of fuel? Then you'll have to walk to get more.
No, the Uber driver will. I'll just call another car.
What if that new Uber driver is a pregnant woman and she goes into labor? You'll have to help. You'll have to wait outside in the cold until help arrives and the roads are already covered with 5 centimeters of snow. It could take the ambulance an hour to get to you. If you're wearing that thin coat, you'll catch your death. The EMTs will find you frozen solid like a block of ice.
Stop, stop. You win. Give me your coat.
Good decision.
Here's my ride.
Don't forget gloves, a hat, and a scarf. Okay, goodbye, have fun.
And that's the end of this Words and Their Stories. I'm Anna Mateo.
Chestnuts roasting. From VOA Learning English, welcome to The Making of a Nation. I'm Steve Ember. In our last program, we talked about President Thomas Jefferson's decisions about who would be in his new government. Jefferson was the leader of a new political party, the Republican Party, but not the Republican Party we know today. In fact, Jefferson's party laid the roots for today's Democratic Party. During the election of 1800, the Jeffersonian Republicans struggled bitterly with the opposition party, the Federalists. Jefferson won that election. In his inaugural address of 1801, he said he wanted to work with the Federalists for the good of the nation. But he chose no Federalists for his cabinet. All the cabinet officers were strong Republicans. All were loyal to Thomas Jefferson. Once President Jefferson formed his cabinet, he began planning the policies of his administration.
Jefferson, of course, thought central government should be almost invisible. He saw its prime role as acting as a sort of referee between the various states, and he wanted to keep it to a minimum.
Andrew O'Shaughnessy directs a Center for Jefferson Studies at Monticello, Thomas Jefferson's home in Virginia. He says Jefferson was especially concerned about the public debt. In the first year of Jefferson's presidency, the government owed millions of dollars. Each year, the debt grew larger because of the interest charged on these loans. Jefferson wanted to balance the budget. Jefferson discussed his financial policy with his two closest advisors. The advisors were Secretary of State James Madison and Treasury Secretary Albert Gallatin. The men agreed that the government must stop spending as much money as it did under former President John Adams, and they agreed that the government must pay its debts as quickly as possible. Albert Gallatin said, "We must have a strong policy. The debt must be paid. If we do not do this, our children, our grandchildren, and many generations to come will have to pay for our mistakes." Jefferson began saving money by cutting unnecessary jobs in the executive branch. He reduced the number of ambassadors, and he dismissed all the tax inspectors. Congress would have to take the next steps. Most government offices, Jefferson said, were created by laws of Congress. Congress alone must act on these positions. The citizens of the United States have paid for these jobs with their taxes. It is not right or just for the government to take more than it needs from the people. President Jefferson also wanted to cut taxes on the production and sale of some products, including whiskey and tobacco. He hoped the government could get all the money it needed from import taxes and from the sale of public lands. The Federalists were furious. They warned that Jefferson's financial program would crush the nation. They declared there would be anarchy if Federalist officials were dismissed. Most people, however, were happy. They liked what Jefferson said. They especially liked his plan to cut taxes. Jefferson's biggest critic was his longtime political opponent, Alexander Hamilton. Hamilton had served as the nation's first Treasury Secretary. Now he was a private lawyer in New York City. He published his criticism of Jefferson in a newspaper he started, the New York Evening Post. In Congress, elected officials also debated the president's proposal to cut taxes. Federalists said it was dangerous for the government to depend mainly on import taxes. They said such a policy would lead to smuggling. People would try to bring goods into the United States secretly without paying customs fees on them. Federalists also said that if the United States cut taxes, it would not have enough money to pay its debts. Then no one would want to invest in the United States again. Republicans said they were not afraid of smugglers. The danger, they said, would come from taxing the American people. There was no need for production and sales taxes. And they said the American people knew it. The Republicans also said they were sure the government would have enough money to pay its debts. The Republicans won this legislative fight. Both the Senate and the House of Representatives voted to approve the president's plan to cut taxes. Congress also had another of Jefferson's proposals to debate. Jefferson wanted to reduce the number of federal courts. The issue had roots in the political divisions between the Federalist and Republican parties, and it started in the closing days of the previous president's term. John Adams was a Federalist. Before Adams left office, Congress passed a Judiciary Act. This act gave Adams the power to appoint as many judges as he wished. The act was a way for the Federalists to keep control of one branch of government after losing the presidency and their majority in Congress in the election of 1800. So President Adams quickly created new courts and named new judges. Just as quickly, the Senate approved them. The papers of appointment were signed. The appointed men were known as midnight judges. However, some of the midnight judges did not receive their papers or commissions before Thomas Jefferson was sworn into office. The new president refused to give them their commissions. Federalist congressmen claimed that the president was trying to interfere with the judiciary. This interference, they said, violated the Constitution. Republican congressmen argued that the Constitution gave Congress the power to create and eliminate courts. They said the former administration had no right to appoint the so-called midnight judges. The Republicans won this argument, too. Congress approved President Jefferson's proposal to reduce the federal courts. Congress then turned to other business. But the question of the midnight judges would not die. One reason the issue remained important was because of a man named William Marbury. Marbury was one of the midnight judges who had never received his commission. He asked the Supreme Court to decide whether the government was required to give him his commission. The Chief Justice of the United States, John Marshall, was a member of the Federalist Party.
Jefferson and Marshall hate each other. In fact, Marshall gives him the oath for the inauguration, and goes back to his room and says, well, a terrorist has just taken over the government. I hope we will be able to survive him.
Joseph Ellis is a historian who has written many books about early American history. He says John Marshall was a towering figure who had an entirely different view of the federal government than Jefferson. Marshall believed the Supreme Court should have the right to veto bills passed by Congress and signed by the president. In the Marbury case, he saw a chance to put this idea into law. Marshall wrote his decision carefully. First, he said that Marbury did have a legal right to his judicial commission. Then he said that Marbury had been denied this legal right. He said no one, not even the president, could take away a person's legal rights. Next, Marshall noted that Marbury had taken his request to the Supreme Court under the terms of a law passed in 1789. That law gave citizens the right to ask the high court to order action by any lower court or by any government official. Marshall explained that the Constitution carefully limits the powers of the Supreme Court. The court can hear direct requests involving diplomats or the states. It cannot rule on other cases until a lower court has ruled. So, Marshall said, the 1789 law allowed Marbury to take his case directly to the Supreme Court. But the Constitution did not. The Constitution, he added, is the first law of the land. Therefore, the congressional law is unconstitutional and has no power. Chief Justice Marshall succeeded in doing all he had hoped to do. He made clear that Marbury had a right to his judicial commission. He also saved himself from a battle with the administration. Most importantly, he claimed for the Supreme Court the power to rule on laws passed by Congress. The case of Marbury versus Madison established that the Supreme Court, not the president or the Congress, has the final say on what the Constitution means. Jefferson did not like Marshall's decision, but Joseph Ellis says that Jefferson was awed by how the Chief Justice argued his case.
Jefferson says to his friends, if you ever talk to Marshall, don't say anything, because whatever you say, he will take it and he will twist it. He calls about twistifications of John Marshall.
Jefferson waited for the Supreme Court to use this new power to change Congress's laws. Several times during Jefferson's presidency, Federalists claimed that laws passed by the Republican Congress violated the Constitution. But they never asked the Supreme Court to reject those laws. The case of Marbury versus Madison was one of the most important decisions about how America's government operates. But historians say another act during Thomas Jefferson's presidency affected America in an even bigger way.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Pete Musto.
And I'm Dorothy Gundy.